This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Good afternoon. Georgia Hargreaves here with you for today's Country Hour, broadcasting live from up in Karratha, here in the beautiful sunny Pilbara. Lucky me. Now, coming up between now and the news at 12:30, finding childcare can be difficult in rural areas. So if you're a new mum, what do you do with your baby during harvest? And after a weather update from the Bureau of Meteorology at midday, South Coast fishers are bracing for increased pressure on local waters following the WA government's ban on demersal fishing on the west coast.
The boats the amateurs are coming down here with, the wreck fishers, are very sophisticated. They've got radar, they've got plotters. There's more and more sophistication going on to those boats. They're professional amateurs just about. And the real problem here is I'm the only commercial fisherman that hand lines on the shelf for 120 miles of coast. You've nearly got 100 amateur boats on the given day that can fish there, and I'm the only commercial. So who is actually taking the fish out of the fishery?
Make sure you stay tuned to hear more on that story before the news at 1 o'clock. It's 12:06. You're listening to the Country Hour. Now, the National Cabinet has agreed to strengthen Australia's gun laws following a meeting of federal, state and territory leaders in the wake of the Bondi terror attack. Governments across the country will work towards implementing a number of options, including limiting the number of firearms, curbing open-ended licensing and restricting gun licenses to Australian citizens. Some people are suggesting the rest of the country should look to WA as a good example of gun law reform. Bron Christensen is the CEO of the Kimberley Pilbara Cattlemen's Association. Bron, obviously WA has just gone through a tightening of gun laws here. What are your thoughts on firearm regulations being strengthened at a federal level?
Oh, look, I think like the rest of Australia, we're all in shock from this attack, really, that a terrorist attack could actually happen on Australian soil. And look, I'll just say that we extend our sympathies to all who have lost someone or were involved or affected in any way. Regarding the tightening of gun laws, I think it's an obvious knee-jerk reaction by the government. The firearm is a tool, and it was a tool that was in the wrong hands. According to the media, of course, we only hear one side of the story, but it does seem that there was a lot of triggers or identifiers there that this perhaps wasn't a suitable person to be owning a firearm. And I guess that comes back to our position, is that firearms are a tool that are used by graziers and pastoralists, and they need to be in the hands of responsible people.
But when you consider how much movement there is across, you know, northern mm-hmm. Australia, for example, I'm thinking about ringers, you know, yep. who are regularly moving through WA and the NT where gun laws are different, do you think yep. there needs to be some sort of consistency across the country?
Look, I don't think anyone would be against consistency across the whole country. I suppose our fear is that if we refer, for example, to the Western Australian gun laws, which are the strictest in Australia, and I'm assuming the government will currently be, the WA government will be saying, yep, absolutely, we've done the right thing. For us, when we've got pastoralists that are non-violent, but because of the one-size-fits-all sweeping reforms that the WA legislation took, we have responsible pastoralists who have previously held a gun licence for 20, 30 years without incident, are now unable to undertake basic animal welfare because of these new laws. So what we can appreciate, you know, that the government will be calling for stricter reforms, and that, yes, there will be a benefit certainly to consistent reforms across all of Australia. But what we would not like to see is the level of reforms that we've seen in WA, where they are a one-size-fits-all, where they don't take into account individual people's characters, or where they don't take into account a real need for a firearm. Will be part of that reform.
If you're just tuning in, this is the WA Country Hour. I'm talking to Bron Christensen from the KPCA this afternoon. And it really feels like the rest of the country is now looking to Western Australia as an example of what gun laws should look like moving forward. Yep. I just want to play you some of what we heard on the breakfast program this morning. We heard from Rowan Brown. He's the Vice President of Gun Control Australia and has been advocating for gun law reform since 1987. Rowan Brown says there's no reason why someone living in suburban Sydney needs access to guns for recreational shooting.
It is unacceptable. Those guns were held pursuant to a recreational hunting licence. Why somebody in suburban Sydney even needs a recreational hunting licence is a complete mystery. Why they would need six guns is a complete mystery. There's a lot of talk about how we want to bring this back to so that the guns are only in the hands of what are called law-abiding shooters. The reality is that as of Sunday morning, the shooter and his son that perpetrated the Bondi massacre were law-abiding shooters. No previous history of anything like this. We don't know who is going to misuse a firearm. We can't predict that. And the only safe course in terms of public policy and promoting public health is to have the most strong gun laws limiting guns of the type used at Bondi and ensuring that people have guns are really well checked out. And Western Australia is leading Australia with mental health checks. We're going to have to go further.
So I'm sure there's a lot of people across the country, Bron, who are thinking, you know, mandatory mental health checks by a GP could potentially prevent future events like what we've just seen happen in Bondi from happening. Do you agree?
No, I don't. On the basis of what we've seen in WA and the feedback that has been public from the College of General Practitioners and other medical entities is that it's impossible to predict, as Rowan just said, it's impossible to predict someone's actions. And I guess if you look at the perpetrators of the Bondi shooting, from what the media is telling us is that, you know, they were on one of them was actually on a watch list. It was a non-Australian person who had a gun license. And that there was indicators there, and if our law enforcement requirements can't actually pick that up when you've got people on watch lists, how do we expect a medical practitioner to be able to do that in a 20-minute consult? I think that just puts way too much pressure on the medical fraternity, and the risk is that, and again, I'm talking about it from a pastoralist and grazier's point of view. The risk is that, and what we're seeing is that male farmers have one of the highest suicide rates in Australia, and so they're just not seeking the services that they should be. Now they've stopped since the WA gun laws came in because they're scared that if I go and say I'm feeling depressed, I think I need help, all of a sudden that medical practitioner is going to be worried about what if they actually don't notify or don't advise that they shouldn't be having a gun license, and then they do go and do something of this nature, which is highly likely they won't. But I guess we're just worried that if you bring this sort of thing in, it puts way too much pressure on the medical fraternity. It also then will limit people who are of need for mental health assistance actually going, non-violent mental health assistance actually going and seeking that support. I guess just from what Rowan was saying there, and I suppose because I'm talking from a pastoralist and graziers, you know, place where a firearm is really just a tool. It's a tool for good animal management and good animal welfare, and it's required. And there are different types of tools, different types of firearms required for different types of animals and different types of activities. With the sporting shooters, and I know the sporting shooters will have their own take on this, but you know, I'm probably in agreement where I can't see why someone in the middle of Sydney needs guns sitting in their cabinet, where if you're a sporting shooter, is it possible then for the gun club to actually host those guns or be having to store those guns so you sign them in and out so there's that little bit more of control rather than stopping a whole sporting shooter industry? I'm not sure, but certainly for us, for pastoralists and graziers, it's a tool that's required.
Surely there's a way of flagging those people that may present a threat to public safety, though. Do you have any better ideas on how to do that, Bron?
Georgia, I think it needs to be based on individual characters. In Western Australia, for example, we had sweeping reforms, which meant that if you'd served more than 5 years or you were sentenced to more than 5 years in jail, for it could be for traffic events, it could be anything that's non-violent. And even if you've only served, say, a year of that term, but it's a mandatory, the longest term is 5 years, that is, you're actually not allowed to have a firearm for that period of time that you could have been in jail plus the time served. So we have several pastorals who are good, upstanding citizens for 30 years, responsible gun owners, all of a sudden are not allowed to own a gun to carry out their business of pastoral and animal management. So I think it has to be on an individual character basis. And I guess that's where the onus, I suppose, relies on the police and checks and historic rather than on our medical profession.
And there's just one more bit of audio I want to play you, Bron. So this is again from Rowan Brown. He's the Vice President of Gun Control Australia. So he is actually making the suggestion that we go one step further and remove recreational hunting as a licence classification. Here's what he's got to say.
There's work to do to bring into effect the reforms from 1996, and the next thing the National Cabinet needs to do and the states and territories need to do is to bring the national gun laws up to date so they're aligned with contemporary values and contemporary technology. So there are some significant changes that need to be made. We need to bring in tightening of the licensing criteria. We need to eliminate recreational hunting as a classification of a license, and we need to have limits nationally on the number of guns that can be held by any one shooter.
So what do you make of what you just heard, Bron?
Look, I'm assuming that Rowan is, he does seem to be focused very much on metropolitan areas. And sporting shooters will you know, have their own arguments for this and their own reasonings behind this. I suppose sporting shooters or recreational hunting serves a purpose in the pastoral industry with pest eradication, where we have a lot of non-property owners who are actually very good shooters and that we actually use for pest eradication, animal pest eradication. So they do have a purpose there.
And just finally, Bron, we are running a bit tired on time, but I just want to know if you were invited to offer your two cents on some sort of national panel looking into gun law reform, what would you say?
Firstly, it has to be based on need. It has to be based on that need has to be assessed. And secondly, that whether or not you can have a gun has to be assessed on your individual character. It shouldn't be bold, sweeping moves that says we've taken the guns off the criminals. For example, in our situation in WA, with the mandatory cessation of a disqualification of a licence if you've served time. But it has to be based on individuals. And I think if we take more time at the outset of giving that gun licence and really assess who the person's getting it, what their need is, hopefully situations like this will not occur. And also the, I suppose, putting the onus back on the people who are policing the guns, which are the police, putting the onus back on them on assessment as opposed to on our medical profession.
Bron, thanks for your time on the Country Hour today.
You're welcome. Thanks for the offer.
CEO of the Kimberley Pilbara Cattlemen's Association, Bron Christensen. It's 18 past 12. You're listening to the WA Country Hour, and I'm keen to get your thoughts on this topic today. 0448 922 604 is the text line if you've got something to say about federal gun law reform and what the other states and territories could potentially learn from WA or what they could do differently. That number again is 0448 922 604. I've already got a couple of texts coming through. This one from Rob in Busselton. This Labor government just does not understand. Rob says, stop pointing at the gun laws. Guns don't kill people. People do. Stop immigrating these dangerous killers. Thanks for that text, Rob. Now, a Midwest farmer who responded to an emergency level bushfire believes much of an iconic century-old mission about 120 kilometres north of Perth has been destroyed. Noah Kowald's family farms on the banks of the Moore River, and he's talking about the fire you've heard about over the last few days near Mogumba, New Norcia and Regan's Ford.
Basically, we've been here for 4 years. We've been trying to grow sheep and a little bit of crop this year. This was supposed to be our first crop, and, well, it's all gone now.
Right. Tell us what happened then.
Okay, so Monday night, as I'm sure many locals in the area would know, we had a great big thunderstorm that came through the area. A lot of lightning. There was a lot of fires around, and one of these sparked in the Mogumba Mission in the bushland near the river. It jumped the river, and Dad and myself, as well as multiple other volunteer fire crews, we got called out to it. We did a bit of back burning, and by about 6 o'clock at night on Monday night, we thought it was under control. And then yesterday morning, the winds picked up and it got away from the crews that were on site at the mission. And it was basically all hands on deck. The fire was burning on two fronts. There was an eastern front, which is where Dad and I were, and there was a southern front that jumped across Mogumba Road West into the olive farm, and then the wind changed and started blowing a westerly, and the fire travelled east, and it got into the chicken farm and my farm. Dad and I were the only ones on that eastern front in the mission with our Land Cruiser, but wire got wrapped around the front diffs, and our ute got damaged, and we just had to get out of there. We couldn't do much.
Okay, is everybody safe?
Yes, for the time being. Thankfully, we have had no human casualties, although we did lose a few firefighter vehicles in the blaze.
Okay, and what about structural damage?
Structural damage? Well, I don't know for certain because I could only watch it from afar, but from my understanding, they've done their best to try and save the Pro 10 chicken farm. They've done their best to try and save the olive farm. The Mogumba Mission, apart from a handful of buildings with asbestos on it, the church building, for one, that's gone. A lot of buildings are gone. It's a mess. There are a handful of buildings still left. It's not a complete write-off, but most of the wooden structures that don't have asbestos on them, they're gone.
Right. And so this is the old Mogumba Mission that dates back decades, doesn't it? It was built mainly of wood?
Mostly of wood, yes. And there's a lot of gums and trees and bushland around there. And the mission had no caretaker this year, and it was left to be overgrown and left to rack and ruin. There was so much overgrowth, we just could not stop it with this wind.
And what about yourselves? What sort of damage have you... What about farmers in the area? What sort of damage are they reporting?
Oh, well, I witnessed it firsthand yesterday. When the fire jumped the mission, at the same time it jumped into the Pro 10 chicken farm, and the barley crop that was in the paddock surrounding it, all the barley that was left standing, all gone. And when it jumped into our west end, all the pasture went up, and so was our... only crop of barley and oats up the back paddock, all gone. We just couldn't stop it. It got to the point where Dad said, we can't stop this thing, Noah, let's get out of here. A lot of the locals have been through this before, so they know the kind of specifics of this type of situation, but it's kind of a first-time thing for us to see a really bad fire.
Wheat and sheep farmer Noah Kowald. He was speaking with Claire Moody about a pretty serious fire around 120 kilometres north of Perth. He was saying the historic Mogumba Hub building is fine. Now, that fire was downgraded to a watch and act warning last night. 23 past 12 on the Country Hour this afternoon. Now, grain harvest is around the clock job, and many are doing it on top of another 24-hour job, being a mum or dad. And finding childcare can be difficult in rural areas. So what do you do with your baby during harvest? That's the question a new mum put out on social media, and she found plenty of parents in the same situation. Natasha Laws is mum to five-month-old Lainey, and this year was their first harvest together in the Riverina.
It hasn't been a harvest without its struggles. We take two headers and our tractor and chase them into West Wyalong every year. We don't put it on a truck because it costs too much money. It's cheaper to just walk it there, which takes 4 hours. So trying to keep a sort of a five-month-old nearly entertained for 4 hours at 40 k's an hour definitely had its troubles. But my partner sort of, we've come to the conclusion that harvest this year was just going to be a little bit different. But she's taken it all in her stride, and she's been in the chase bin and in the header. And yeah, it's just, it's been an adjustment, but it's something that we needed to do, and it's our way of life.
And so your five-month-old daughter, you put a post up on social media asking for some advice, maybe from some other parents, of what to do with little babies. What was some of the reaction you got?
Yeah, so I put a post on a Facebook page and just sort of asking, you know, like what other mums do with their babies in the tractors and how like they're keeping them comfortable, entertained and everything like that. And the response has been good, and like there was comments of other things that I didn't think of for as she gets older. So it was, you know, like making sure you put like a dog collar or a chain on the door so that they don't open it while you're driving and, you know, then potentially fall out. And just other like suggestions of people using their capsules, but even suction caps and shade cloth that you can be able to then move around on the windows of the tractor to keep the shade off them, which I didn't even think of because I'd only had blankets hung over the door and muslin wraps tied on the steering wheel and things like that just to try and keep the sun off her a little bit. So it was definitely really good to hear other mums' perspectives and just see photos of their setups in their tractors. You're not the only person doing it. Like, farming is part of Australia. It's part of our livelihood, and there's plenty of mums everywhere doing it.
And how did she go in the header and in the tractor? She looks pretty comfy in the photo.
Yeah, she's been really good. She sort of has a few sleeps, and if she needs a decent sleep, I'll pop her in the carrier and sort of just drive around the paddock a little bit, and she sort of nods off pretty quickly. And then, yeah, it's just giving her a few toys. And obviously she's only 5 months old, so she doesn't need a lot. And she is also currently a breastfed baby, so I don't have to prepare bottles and things like that. So I think that makes life a little bit easier for her being in the tractor. She's been perfect. She put her in the header and she sits there and watch the reel spins around all afternoon. And she definitely enjoys it and pays. She's a very much a sticky beak baby, so she pays attention to everything and takes it all in. And yeah, give her another 4 years and she'll be driving it herself, I think.
Yeah, that's it. You can show her her first harvest when she's asleep in a little bed.
Definitely.
I guess, were you surprised at the reaction you got? I mean, like, it seems like, yeah, lots of people had little tricks and tips, and yeah, lots of people are out doing harvest with babies on board.
Yeah, so I definitely didn't expect to get the reaction or even the amount of responses that I did. But then even just seeing other mums jumping on, or like future mums that like they're pregnant now and sort of also wondering how they're going to juggle that work-life balance or even just the family life balance, because, you know, the businesses and or working on farms where you've just got to sometimes jump in and help, you don't have the readily available facilities of like grandparents or even daycare to be able to sort of take the kids and drop them off when they're this little, or obviously there's no school. But yeah, just hearing other mums say that, you know, thank you for this because it's helped sort of get us prepared, and, you know, like they know that it is doable and that they can sort of have that work-life balance with Bub in the tractor. And it was good to see. And other mums sort of going, you know, props for good mum and taking Bub out and things like that. So it was really nice to hear and sort of uplifting at the same time.
Natasha Laws from Nangis, which is over in New South Wales, she was speaking with Annie Brown about her first harvest with her five-month-old daughter, Lainey. It's 28 past 12 on the Country Hour this afternoon. I've got some texts coming through in reference to potential federal gun law reform and sort of the idea of other states and territories looking to WA as a model. This one's from Mal in Wooddenilling. He says in 2017 and 2023, There were people who tragically died in Bourke Street, Melbourne, run down by cars. 12 people all up. No one called for cars to be banned. Thanks for that text. Mal, if you'd like to be part of the conversation this afternoon, the number is 0448 922 604. It's the same number as usual. And sheep and lamb numbers were down at Mushay today, about 5,000 less than last week. So just before the news at 1 o'clock, Terry Birkin will let you know if that resulted in higher prices. For now, though, it's 12:30, time for an update from the newsroom. Jonathan Beale is here. What's making headlines today, Jonathan?
Thanks, Georgia. In the headlines, the Premier, Roger Cook, says he's looking forward to working with his New South Wales counterpart, Chris Minns, to strengthen Australia's firearms laws. A suite of changes will be considered by all state and territory leaders, including scrapping open-ended licences and restricting the number of guns a licensee can own. WA implemented those measures earlier this year. Mr Cook says he wants to help make all Australians safer. The Prime Minister says he's looking to accelerate the establishment of a national firearms register, which is currently not due to start until 2028. Anthony Albanese says he's ready for the fight against gun lobbyists who may advocate against stricter controls. And the WA Local Government Association has called for more funding for volunteer firefighters in next year's state budget. In the state's southern half, 5 emergency level bushfires were burning at once yesterday. Volunteers are almost always first on scene at regional bushfires, but WALGA President Karen Chappell says they're in need of funding for equipment and training. Ms Chappell says with farm sizes increasing, volunteers need funding more than ever. More news, Georgia, at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Jonathan. It is 29 to 1 o'clock.
Before emergencies happen, be ready with ABC Radio WA. Check your battery-powered radio today and go to reception.abc.net.au to find your local ABC radio frequency and stay connected with ABC Radio WA.
Right now, off to the Bureau of Meteorology. We've got Caroline Crowe from the Bureau. Caroline, let's start in the south of the state today. What can we expect?
Yeah, good afternoon, Georgia. Okay, so for the south of the state, the west coast has got some mild, though more humid conditions than what it has the last few days. That southwesterly, or those onshore winds on the coast and just adjacent parts. East of that is where our trough is sitting, so and still seeing some quite hot temperatures and those northerly wind regime through the remaining parts of the Southwest Land Division today. Not expecting any thunderstorms through the Southwest Land Division today. They should remain further north and away from the Southwest Land Division. They might get the very odd shower just along the south coast near Albany or the southwest corner later today as we start getting that moist onshore airstream pushing over still. Coming into Wednesday, we should see that mild southwesterly winds pretty much throughout the Southwest Land Division by 8 o'clock or sort of that just after sunrise tomorrow. Still looking at Wednesday, though, most of the showers and thunderstorms associated with the trough should then be further northeast as well. So far northeastern parts of the Southwest Land Division might get a thunderstorm later tomorrow. And we're talking sort of more northeast Southern Cross and possibly sort of well inland from that Esperance area. So very, very far north and outskirts of the Southwest Land Division. About the southwest corner, though, we could still see a couple of those odd showers maintaining in that onshore airstream, and those showers are looking as though they will sort of continue to extend along through southern coastal districts of the Southwest Land Division through the remaining part of the week to the weekend. So there is a cold front, as well as those onshore wind, there is a weak cold front that's going to brush along the south coast coming into Friday into Saturday. So only light showers expected from that. As we continue sort of just on the thunderstorm front for the remaining parts of the Southwest Land Division, so I mentioned far northeastern parts coming into tomorrow. Thursday, very similar. The thunderstorms do contract a little bit further north, so still through the far northeast of the central wheat belt, so around Southern Cross and northern parts. It may also creep into far inland parts of the Central West District coming into Thursday. And then as we progress into Friday, they do extend further west and south as well. So looking at a good part of the Southwest Land Division, probably if you draw a line from around the Lanceland area through to west of Bremer Bay, northeast of that line is where our thunderstorms are expected on Friday. And then coming into Saturday, it's a fairly similar line of where those thunderstorms are, maybe a little bit further northeast, and they'll gradually push, continue to push northeast as well.
Okay, let's take a look at what's happening further north of the state. What's in store?
Yeah, through northern parts of the state, Georgia, there's pretty much showers and thunderstorms continuing. So at the moment, we've got them through the Kimberley and also developing through the interior, and may also see them develop through into most parts. So the central and eastern parts of the Pilbara, inland parts of the Gascoyne, getting into northern parts of the Goldfields, and as that interior and Kimberley, as I mentioned. Through the Kimberley, though, they are quite slow moving, and there's been of rainfall around, so some of those thunderstorms have had some heavy falls out of them, getting 30 mils in 30 minutes or an hour, just because they've been quite slow moving, and we can expect that to continue sort of into the remainder of the week as well. For the boundary of the thunderstorms as we progress into Wednesday, still fairly similar thunderstorms through the Kimberley, northern part or the north interior, central western parts of the Pilbara, inland Gascoyne, and getting into the Goldfields and western parts of the Eucla. Very similar for Thursday as well, maybe a little bit less area through the Pilbara, but fairly similar. And then coming into Friday, the thunderstorms will have extended more west as well. So we're looking at, as well as through the Kimberley, north interior, parts of the Pilbara, pretty much throughout the Gascoyne, most parts of the Goldfields, right down to that Eucla coast again, and then most of northern and eastern parts as we continue into Saturday as well. So quite a few thunderstorms around at this point in time for those northern and eastern parts. Temperatures in the Kimberley have been a little bit below average with all the cloud and those thunderstorms around.
Very good. Thank you so much for the update, Caroline. It is 24 to 1 on the Country Hour this afternoon. Time to see what's happening in the rainfall department. Richard Hudson, how's it all going?
Yeah, and most of the activities in the north, as is often the case at this time of year, in the Kimberley, Curtin Airport had 20 mils, Diggers Rest 22, Ellenbrae 10, Fitzroy Crossing 24, Kachana 9, Kalumburu 30, Leopold Downs 21, Mount House 6 mils, Mount Winifred 15, Sturt Creek had 5, Theta 13, Udiala 9, Wyndham 34, Yampi Sound 84. Then in the Pilbara there was a few good downpours as well. Marble Bar had 18 and Telfer, just about the rainfall capital of the Pilbara this year, had 53 mils. And then you've got to go down to the Southwest Land Division to find any other rain of significance. In the Central Wheat Belt, Balgarda had a bit of a downpour with 36 and Mullawar 5. Nothing in the Lower West or the Southwest, but in the Southern Coastal area, Stirling South had 5, Tamar 10, Wellstead 7. And then in the Central Wheat Belt, Ardeth 19, Babbican 11, Belka East 8, Cunderdon 7, Corder 11, Tamman 13. And then in the Great Southern Patch, Nyabing's GRDC rain gauge tipped out 7 mils and Wickapin East had 5. Georgie, you were just mentioning about the fire hazards and a fair few fires that are burning. Just quickly to go through the information on, firstly, total fire ban. So due to the risk of fire, a whole heap of shires do have a total fire ban in place today. So they cover local government areas in the Midwest, in the Wheat Belt, Goldfields and Esperance and the Great Southern regions. I won't read them all out. There is a full list on the Emergency WA website, which thankfully is working today. And if you need any information, not only which shires have a total fire ban in place, but also what you can and can't do during a total fire ban, it's all on that homepage. Just go to search emergency in WA and it's all up there. It is your responsibility to check with your local government if there's a harvest and vehicle movement ban, and a number of shires do have them in place today. When I last looked, all of these shires have a harvest ban in place right now. So that's Boyup Brook, Broomhill Tambalup, Cuballing, Noangarup, Jeramungup, Katanning, Condinnan, Narrogin Shire, Ravensthorpe, West Arthur, Williams, Woodnilling and Yilgarn. And if you need information as to the lifting of any harvest bans, just make sure you're staying tuned to your actual shire itself, getting in touch with the shire itself. Those fires you mentioned that were in the Midwest, some of them are still at a watch and act. Other fires that are burning in the southern parts of Western Australia are at an advice level. All the latest information is on the Emergency WA website as well. Easy to find on the homepage. The most serious warnings are at the very top, and then you work your way down. And you can also access that information on the Emergency WA app. Some of those fires have been burning for a number of days, so again, I won't go through those details. But Georgia, fishing's certainly been in the news for the last week or so, hasn't it?
It has, yes. Big topic at the moment.
In a moment, we're also going to hear from some of the people who represent various organisations. But first up, South Coast Fishers say they're bracing for increased pressure on local waters as fishing effort shifts following the state government's decision to permanently shut down commercial demersal fishing on the west coast. Graham Drew has been a commercial fisher on the south coast for more than 40 years. He's based near Bremer Bay and he fishes under hand lining licences, running a bait fish operation, supplying sardines, while also targeting deep water demersal species. He says the flow-on effects of the West Coast shutdown are already being felt.
We will lose profit because of the closures that we will look at, but not only that, the effort will come straight off the West Coast and it will come down onto the South Coast. So you're going to get a large amount of overfishing on the South Coast, which is detrimental to all of the South Coast fishermen in the long term.
What sort of percentage loss are you guys looking at?
Look, you could be 20-30%, you know, and then it becomes unviable to even go. So unless we catch a certain amount of fish each trip, you know, because we burn 1,000 litres of fuel and you've got wages and all these types of things, sometimes you're better off, you make more money if you stay home.
What kind of pressure does it place on you guys in the South Coast to see more fishers shifting from the west coast to south coast waters?
Well, you've got extended bag limits on the south coast. The bag limits need to be reduced. And the boats the amateurs are coming down here with, the wreck fishers, are very sophisticated. They've got radar, they've got plotters. There's more and more sophistication going on to those boats. They're professional amateurs just about. And the real problem here is I'm the only commercial fisherman that hand lines on the shelf for 120 miles of coast. You've nearly got 100 amateur boats on the given day that can fish there, and I'm the only commercial. So who is actually taking the fish out of the fishery?
The Fisheries Minister has said that she expects an adjustment period and for people to flock to the south coast to fish. And she also has flagged that there potentially will be a review of recreational bag limits in March. How do you see that playing out on the south coast after all of that?
But if it's March, the damage is already done because the people will come off the west coast, January, February, March. You've got 3 months. They can slaughter these fisheries. And then we have another real issue. And I've pointed this out to fisheries and at the meetings in Perth. We have two trawlers working in the Bight. For 30-odd years, they were predominantly flathead, catching flathead. Now, I believe their fisheries collapsed. They're targeting Harpooka and red bite fish, which is Nanagai. But a lot of the fish coming off those trawlers are actually undersized, what we'd say undersized, 1 kilo fish, 1.5 kilo Nanagai. Well, red snapper. What I believe is happening here is our spawning of the Nanagai on the south coast, predominantly the eggs get pushed to the east. So that is our breeding area for all of our future Nanagai for the next 20, 30 years. But these trawlers have been allocated under the Commonwealth licences 500 tonne WHO approved taking of Nanagai alone in the Bight. So they're predominantly working our juvenile stock, and then they're sending it from Adelaide to Perth, and the problem is then they sell it in Perth for $4 or $5 a kilo whole. Mm. Where if I sell it from here, we're getting $12, $14, $15 a kilo. So they're undermining West Australia but taking it back to South Australia to unload it. But it's the amount that they're taking out. it's going to crucify this fishery.
Is there a risk that increased effort here could lead to tighter rules or even a closure in the future for the South Coast?
Yes, definitely. Yep. We can see it coming. I mean, for 3 years now, I've been pushing the fisheries to close down the Harpooka fishery while they're spawning, and nothing's happened. And the argument back from fisheries was how do we control the amateur take? We don't know what they're taking. But the commercial industry wants for that 2 or 3 months while they're spawning and they're schooled up in big schools, we stop taking them. But until now, nothing's happened.
Well, with the demersal fishing off the table in the West Coast for commercial fishers, what species do you expect fishers will turn to? And can you guys just turn to that as well? Is there concern about pressure on the pelagic species?
Not really. I mean, I fish here, like I say, for 40 years, and I predominantly target blue-eye, harpooka, the deep water fish, nanogai, snapper. Those types of fish, but yeah, we can't really turn to others that are in viable amounts, you know. So because the other species are a lot less lower valued in the market, so we are targeting those fish, trying to maintain a higher price in the market.
What's your view on compensation for fishers affected by the West Coast shutdown, the commercial fishers? What's your view on that?
Look, how far does it go? You know, the problem with compensation is, yes, there may be some people there, but it's all the people like the deckhands, the boat builders, all the rest of them. You know, no doubt there's people have boats ordered are being cancelled. It'll flow right through. This is going to have a huge effect. And I suppose one of the real relevant points here, they say, oh, well, in a couple of years, we may let commercial start again. No, it won't. You know why? Because you've lost the expertise out of the fishery. You're taking a whole generations of fishermen, you're taking them out of the fishery. They won't come back. Their children won't come back because they don't want to be in the same situation of what this government has done. And myself on the South Coast, and I know the fishermen on the West Coast, it's not research-based. You can't blame the fisheries for this, the fisheries research. It is political right to the top.
So are you saying that by them backing science and saying the demersal species is sort of on the brink of extinction, that it's not, you believe it's not?
Of course not. Any fisherman, if you go out in the water any day of the week, I can take you out here and show you. Anytime. And the fishermen on the southwest and Augusta and all those other places can do exactly the same. Yeah. Why was the research targeted onto Sandy Bottom up off Kalbarri by the university? And it came from the very people. They said, we were told to do this because we had to get a result. And this was the result. There's no fish here.
And do you think, like yourself on the South Coast, operators should also be considered for compensation given the flow-on effects?
Oh, well, there will be a... It's the start. The West Coast has been smashed. Now, within the agenda, we are the next one in line.
Graham Drew, he's a commercial fisherman who operates Bremer Fish Processors in Bremer Bay, which is on the south coast of WA. And you heard him there sharing some of his concerns about the recent changes to regulation around fishing and commercial fishing. He was chatting to Rachel Boothman. It's 12 to 1. You're listening to the WA Country Hour this afternoon. You've got me in the hot seat, Georgia Hargreaves. It's great to be here. And I'm really keen to hear from you this afternoon on this topic. Is this something that impacts you if you're a commercial fisherman, or potentially you're concerned about extra pressure from recreational fishers in, you know, sort of moving to other areas? 0448 922 604 is the text line if you'd like to be part of the conversation.
And Georgia, you might have seen in the West Australian newspaper today, there's a full page advertisement, if you like, and it's from the WA Fishing Industry Council. It's publishing an open letter to the Premier and state government. WAFIC represents commercial fishers, and the letter says its members believe the recent fishing announcements went too far. It's mainly referring to the permanent ban on commercial fishing of demersal fish between Kalbarri and Augusta that we've just been talking about. The letter says the Premier, this is not reform, this is unfair and deeply damaging. WAFIC CEO Melissa Haslam is calling on the Premier to come to the table and talk to them sensibly.
This was an absolute sledgehammer approach. There was nothing in the science that demands a permanent closure of commercial fishing. And it affects everyone. That will affect seafood supply to so many West Australians, restaurants and markets, fish and chip shops. And it was without warning. It came as a complete shock. No one had spoken to us about total closures or even suggested it. Permanently, I should add. So we're just saying, come back to the table and talk to us. There's some solutions in here that haven't been explored.
But was it really a big shock? Didn't you have some inkling that this was the way we were going?
We were expecting there would be some closures. We had absolutely no expectation that it would be permanent bans, completely prohibiting any commercial fishing forever. And we had absolutely no idea all our shark fishermen were about to be drawn into this either.
Now, Melissa Haslam is calling on the Premier to make some changes to those recent reforms to the bans, basically to ensure that sometime in the future, when demersal fish stocks recover, hopefully, it won't be just those who can afford big recreational fishing boats that can enjoy eating fish, such as snapper, jewfish and red emperor.
Look, there's a number of things that can be done. I mean, in the face of the fact that we are facing a closure right now for at least, say, 2 years, then there will be some fishermen who will need to go now. They will have no choice. Their mortgages, their business demands, the way they operate, they can't wait out that amount of time. So there will be some fishermen who will say, we'll immediately leave. We will be left with a smaller pool of fishermen who can sustain that time, but who could return to commercial fishing thereafter and supply some fish to the community. And rather than looking at a sledgehammer approach for the entire West Coast from north of Kalbarri to Augusta, and this is what we've been saying from the beginning, break it up into smaller regions, because there are localised solutions in that haven't even been considered.
Now, WAFIC also believes the $20 million figure mentioned by State Fisheries Minister Jackie Jarvis, as far as compensation goes, is totally inadequate. She thinks it should be five times that amount.
So around the entire coast, there were 331 licence holders. On that west coast alone, there's at least 53 demersal licence holders and another approximately 20 shark license holders. All of those at this moment in time have to be exited. There is absolutely no way that all of their boats, their gear, some of them vertically integrated, there's processing facilities attached to it. Absolutely no way, Noan, is $20 million sufficient.
And what do you think is sufficient?
I would think it would be in excess of $100 million.
So on the topic of compensation, Shadow Fisheries Minister Kiralee Waugh agrees with WAFIC that $20 million is just not enough.
There is a great concern from the industry, and we're really concerned for the people that are going to be impacted by this. And it's not just the fishers themselves, it's families, it's deckhands, it's communities, it's tourism operators, it's regional communities, it's processors. It's a whole heap of different people. And to say that there's only 41 boats impacted, that's simply not good enough by the Minister. It shows little regard for the people that actually are impacted and how this will be widespread across our West Australian communities.
Has any time frame been given for compensation?
No, not yet. No detail hasn't been released from my understanding, but there will be a lag time. But I have heard recently, Jess, that to be eligible for that compensation, the fishers have been told they need to pay $100 for their licence to maintain it. So if you don't have a valid licence, you won't be eligible for compensation. That came from a fisher to me yesterday, and that's very disappointing of the government to say you need to pay for your licence that you can't even fish with anymore to be eligible. It smacks of absolute disdain to the people that actually are impacted.
Is there any hope of overturning this ban that the government's plans, given it has already been gazetted, or are you moving on to kind of how you can live with it?
Look, we're not giving up the fight. We're certainly standing with those fishers that are going to be impacted and those communities that are, and we're certainly using every lever we can in terms of the parliamentary process to make our message clear to the Minister.
Is a disallowable motion possible?
Well, it was gazetted yesterday and we're making consideration on that.
Shadow Fisheries Minister Kiralee Waugh at a media conference this morning. Well, you just heard Graeme Drew explaining how his South Coast fishing business is going to be affected by these changes. Let's get back to Melissa Haslam from WAFIC, because she says there's actually something wrong with the fish stock data being used by the state government.
The whole South Coast is high risk, according to the state government. But in exactly the same water, there's a Commonwealth fishery that is MSC certified that takes the same fish. And they have an MSC tick of approval for being sustainable. So how can we have this discrepancy? Like, something's not quite right.
WAFIC CEO Melissa Haslam speaking to Geraldine Mellett on today's morning show. Well, Professor Jessica Maywig is director of the Marine Futures Lab at the University of Western Australia, and she agrees with Melissa Haslam on a number of fronts.
So it is an absolutely terrible decision to close the commercial fishery forever for two reasons. One, so I totally agree with Melissa that this is a terrible decision. I probably disagree on the solutions, but so it's wrong for two reasons. The first reason is that it's not going to work. When they open up the fishery exclusively to recreational fishers in 2 years, we'll end up in the exact same position. And there's good evidence from all over the world that when you reallocate a fishery from commercials to recs, they just take all of the fish and you're back to the same.
And is that spot. A matter of time? Like, we haven't given them enough time to recover?
That's exactly it. So a fish that lives to 40 years cannot recover in two. You know, so if humans, for instance, had the same structure, age structures as G-fish, 90% of us would be dead by age 30. That's what they're talking about, right? So You can't just say, oh, 2 years are going to work and then it's all over to the wrecks. But the other reason that it's really wrong is that it is a public resource. If you reallocate G-fish and the other demersals exclusively to wreck fishers, you're undermining restaurants, you're undermining tourism. Mm. I was just at the parrot events that the WA government, you know, invested in. And there was local fish on every single event, just about. So this is a crazy, crazy idea that A is not going to work and is grossly unfair.
Professor Jessica Maywig, she's director of the Marine Futures Lab at UWA.
And about 11,500 sheep were sold at the Mouchet sale yards today. Terry Birkin's been there all morning. Hi, Terry. Can you run us through the numbers, please?
Numbers were backed by approximately 5,000 head for the last sale of 2025. The sale had some lines of very well-presented shorn lambs and good lines of heavy ewes against a large proportion of secondary and tail-end ewes and lambs. Stall lambs eased $5 to $7, while lambs with condition remained firm, and the mutton market in general was also softer by $5 to $7 a head. Tail-end small-frame stall lambs started from $40 up to $90, while bigger-frame stalls with a quicker turnover sold from $100 to $171 a head. Light lambs made $165 to $208, while trade weights returned $191 to $234 a head. Most heavy lambs sold from $230 to $286, with one exceptional pen realising $312 a head. The few merino weather hoggets available sold from $101 to $208, while light merino ewe hoggets were making $90 to $159, and heavy weights sold to a top of $210 a head. Crossbred hoggets on the heavier side returned $158 to $276, and younger rams sold to a top of $240 a head. Very plain and light frame tail end ewes were selling from $34 to $90, while bigger frame boning grades were making $100 to $172. Medium weights returned $160 to $220, and heavy ewes sold to a top of $240 a head. Heavy weathers ranged from $209 to $240, while mature rams sold from $32 to $148 a head. And just a reminder that the first sheep sale at Mouchet will be on the 6th of January. This is Terry Birkin for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you for the update, Terry. So those numbers again, 5,936 lambs, 5,584 sheep. So the total number is down on last week by about 5,000. It's 1 minute to 1 o'clock, almost time for the news update. First, though, I want to share some pretty big property news with you. Consolidated Pastoral Company, CPC, has purchased the Beetaloo aggregation of stations in the Northern Territory in a historic deal worth well over $300 million. The aggregation is more than 1 million hectares in size, which includes Beetaloo Station, OT Downs and Mungabroom Station. Land title documents show the aggregation settled on December 9th for $300 million plus the value of the herd, which is understood to be about 90,000 head in size. You can read more on this story online if you are interested. Just do a search on the ABC News website for Beetaloo and NT. And you'll find that story. Thanks for your company on the Country Hour this afternoon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.